Okay, dann können wir bei. Still want the comfort break. Okay. The draft bill before us. Financial management of parliament bill. As members would recall, we had done some extensive work on this bill. And as I indicated yesterday, I think it is time that we that arise out of the consultation process with the minister and then some other outstanding issues that might change the outlook of the bill. Thanks.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, members, colleagues, and visitors. Consultation on the bill with the Minister of Finance in terms of the PFMA has concluded, and the Minister made some recommendations which I think the committee accepted, but just I've prepared a memo on this issue dated 11th August, which was distributed, I believe. The amendments to the bill as it stands pertains to clause 23 and 72. The issue of clause 23 is just that it's about returning or not returning the Parliament's unspent funds. And there the Minister pointed out that the bill as it stands only looks at appropriated funds. And what about other funds? So let's include all money there. So my suggestion would then be to redraft clause 23.1 and to include there that to read as follows. Parliament is not required to return to the National Revenue Fund any money appropriated or approved. So one will put in any money, remove funds, and then include after appropriate or approved, but not spent in that year. And that should, in my opinion, take care of the Minister's concern. And then concerning clause 72, the Minister said there are now duplications in the financial management of Parliament Bill compared to the PFMA, and to remove those duplications as a matter of good drafting practice, remove Parliament and from clause 13.5 and then also to repeal clause 13.1A of the PFMA. 13.1A of the PFMA refers to Parliament, it refers about deposits into the National Revenue Fund, and then 13.5 of the PFMA refers to Parliament that must deposit money into a bank account. And now, if the FAPLA bill takes care of that, the Minister thinks, well, we should then remove those out of the FAPLA bill and remove Parliament completely out of the PFMA. In my opinion, those suggested amendments to clause 72, the addition of subclauses 3 and 4, takes care of that. And that's the issue of the Minister of Finance's consultation, or the consultation in terms of the PFMA, I should say. Should I continue, Honourable Chair, on the other issues?
Yeah, are we okay with that section? In fact, we had dealt with that issue in our previous meeting. Okay, proceed, Advocate.
The other issues that I highlighted last time was various meetings have taken place on the latest version of the draft bill, and there were two issues that came out, a few issues that came out. One was some sort of the structure of financial management that the bill is trying to set up there, and there were some concerns, firstly with clause 6 of the bill. Clause 6 of the bill says that this bill is administered by the Secretary of Parliament, who is the accounting officer, under the control of the executive authority. Now, the concern there was, is it appropriate that an accounting officer, who is an official, should be administering an act of Parliament? And my view on that is that it's not necessary to break one's head about this. This bill actually, like the PFMA, tries to set out responsibilities for the executive authority and responsibilities for the accounting officer. So each have their different responsibilities. That goes to the sort of the reason of the existence of the PFMA, to let managers manage and focus on the outputs and the outcomes, and the officials allowing them to manage and focus on their responsibilities. So my suggestion to Clause 6 is to replace Clause 6.1 and actually just to say there that the Secretary of Parliament is the accounting officer. So one will read that Part 3, the sort of the administration of the Act. I think the heading is still appropriate because it tries to indicate what are the functions of the Secretary there. And indirectly one is then saying that these are your functions, well, not indirectly, directly, these are your functions, you are the accounting officer and this is what you must do. The issue of accountability to the executive authority is still there, but I feel that 6.1 is creating maybe more confusion than clarity, the way it is drafted now, and therefore the concerns have come out. I don't think it changed any meaning of the Act or any purpose of the Act. The second concern was with Clause 9. Can I just ask if all the members received this document I've prepared? It's dated 10 September, and it says proposed wording for consideration by the Portfolio Committee on Finance.
Okay.
I'm working off that.
Have all members got it? Okay. Yeah.
That's fine. That's Clause 6. Clause 9 of the bill refers to the acting accounting officer. And there were concerns from the management team of Parliament that if you say that if the accounting officer is unable to perform the function must be performed by the deputy secretary. You are creating the position deputy secretary in the bill. It might bind Parliament's hands at a later stage if Parliament doesn't want the deputy secretary, or if there's more than one deputy secretary. Then one needs clarity on that. So the suggestion that I've come up with to remove that kind of concern is just to actually elevate the last part of B, 9B, so that the Clause 9 would then basically read, without any subdivisions, if the post of accounting officer is vacant or if the accounting officer is unable to perform the functions of the post, those functions must be performed by another official designated in writing by the executive authority. It doesn't actually remove much from it, except that there is not that explicit role for the deputy secretary to play. I might add that the deputy secretary was involved in these discussions and he agreed with it as well, saying it's not necessary to pinpoint this. I might add that the PFMA also doesn't have that kind of detail in the bill, in the Act. The next clause is Clause 16, Honourable Chair. It pertains to your annual budget. The issue with Clause 16, specifically Clause 16.2H, is that the clause as it stands requires Parliament's budget must be in accordance with the format prescribed under Section 76, read with Section 27.3 of the Public Finance Management Act. So what we have there is that Parliament's budget must be in a format, and if one looks at the regulations, that format is determined in terms of Treasury circulars and instructions. It actually doesn't give you that level of detail in the regulations itself. So it was a bit difficult to actually there replace, and the issue is really to emphasize the separation of powers here and not to have a cross-reference to a bill that's under the administration of the executive, but for Parliament to create its own set of regulations then. But as I said, the method of doing this would be then to look at what the regulations and what the PFMA itself says and trying to take that wording and the concept and to bind Parliament to that rather than to cross-refer to the PFMA, which will always then allow the Minister to as I said, send a circular and change that, basically determine Parliament's internal proceedings. I try to keep the issue of uniform norms and standards as well there. So my suggestion is rather to say that the Parliament's budget must be in accordance with the format prescribed under Section 65, not of the PFMA, but 65 of this Act. which means those regulations will be drafted by the executive authority. And then to add for the purpose of maintaining consistency with the format followed by other organs of state. Now, I would just like to point out to the committee here that the wording I suggest or propose there is very wide. I mean, organs of state is a very wide concept. So what Parliament will have to do is look at what is out there in organs of state, and that distinction can then be drawn between your issues of public entities, government departments, constitutional institutions. That's the major distinctions drawn in the PFMA. So when Parliament or when the executive authority must draft these regulations, they will have to go look at those, see if there's a sort of a common denominator and see what will work for Parliament. But it has to be consistent broadly with what is happening in other organs of state. Because the next few suggestions in the document pertains to very similar issues here, I'd like to also point out that in Clause 2 of the bill, where the purpose, the objects of the acts are set out, there is reference to ensure a consultative relationship between Parliament and the National Treasury and based on respect for budget processes, standards of generally recognized accounting practice, etc., etc. So I think when one reads the suggested wording in 16.2H in the context of Section 2, it is not a sort of a arbitrary discretion that's given to Parliament to come up with their own regulations. I'm saying this not because the intention is to bind Parliament, but the intention is to ensure uniform norms and standards within the context of separation of powers. Honourable Chair, the next clause is clause 34.
Okay, can I just check if there are any questions with regards to that? Because, I mean, to me it sounds quite clear and acceptable. If none, Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. I think it is moving in the right direction. The concern, certainly, that we had was that, you know, we do have to have a standard and it must be quite clear what it is. And you are talking about consistency with other organs of state. I think that is fine. But as you mentioned, there are many different types of organs of state. I don't know if it's possible to maybe narrow it down slightly because, I mean, this is a specific entity. It's unlike some organs of state. So I would feel a little bit more comfortable if we could tighten it up a little bit. I don't have a solution, but I'm just thinking that might be possible. If it isn't, that's fine. But, you know, I would like it a bit tight if we could. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, let's just flag it for now. Then perhaps members can apply their minds when we, I mean, but if we cannot, like Dr. George is saying, if we cannot, as far as I'm concerned, I don't see how best we can tighten it. But let's get back to it towards the end and see whether there isn't anything. Put together our minds, our legal minds this side, our political minds this side, pull them together. We'll see whether it is possible to narrow it beyond this, because I would have imagined this actually does force us to some kind of uniformity when we refer to being consistent with, you know, what currently obtains in other organs of state. But let's come back to it.
Thank you, Chair. Clause 34 is, I think, something, the proposal there that doesn't have to do with separation of powers. I think it's something that, from my side, fell off my desk. The issue there was there's a duplication in the bill. I mean, Parliament's annual financial statements must actually indicate specifically. I just want to actually refer the committee to the correct issue.
34.
No, 34 is there, Honourable Chair. The issue I'm looking for is that when one looks at the financial statements of Parliament, there's a requirement that it must set out the money Parliament has then transferred to political parties and whether that money was used for the purposes of that. And that would be then be an issue for Parliament's books, which the joint committee to which it's referred can then debate, consider, and come up with a resolution. Of course, they will be debating the Auditor General's report on those statements as well. What Clause 34 does is, in addition to that, it requires that each political party's books must be tabled in the House and be available for the public. One, it's a duplication, and two, if those individual books get tabled as such and not as as Parliament's book, you're going to have the situation where there's going to be a debate in a committee about different political parties' way of spending that money. And that, I don't think that's the intention of the bill. The intention of the bill is to have a financial management of Parliament, not financial management of political parties. So I think the duplication is unnecessary. My suggestion is just to remove H and I, and then, of course, to correct all the numbering of those paragraphs. Clause 47 has to do with the audit committee. The issue there was specifically subclause 5, 47.5, which requires that the terms of appointment and the remuneration of members of the audit committee must be consistent with the requirements for audit committee prescribed under the PFMA. And once again, one wants to get away from that cross-referencing. So what I did, I went and looked at the issues that in the Treasury regulations pertaining to an audit committee and to see whether those issues are captured there. And I'm not going to take committees through it unless it's required, but I mean the issue of independence, the issue of competency, those are covered by the bill as such. I did see that the issue of the chairperson of the committee, of the audit committee, the Treasury regulations require sort of a more stringent test for the chairperson. The chairperson must be aware of the importance of that position and must have the appropriate skills. So my first suggestion to clause 47 is to insert that specifically in clause 47.4, just to insert there who is knowledgeable of the status of the position and have the requisite business, financial, and leadership skills. Now, that comes out of the Treasury regulations. And then clause 47.5, instead of to say prescribed under the Public Finance Management Act, rather to say it must be consistent with other audit committees of other organs of state, taking into account, and remember what we're talking about here is the terms of appointment and remuneration, taking into account tariffs determined by the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants in consultation with the AG, or Auditor General, and tariffs determined by the National Treasury. Now, those tariffs and those determinations are found in the Treasury regulations, or those references to those. So what we're doing is we're actually saying, rather than being determined by those external factors, external to Parliament, Parliament must determine the remuneration in terms of employment, of terms of service of the audit committee. But these must then be consistent with audit committees operating in other organs of state, and you must take into account when you determine which will be now the appropriate level in other organs of state, because one can imagine there's some smaller entities, there's also shared audit committees for different government departments or entities, and then you'll have a huge government departments and smaller government departments. So what one will have to do is just to see what exactly would be comparable to what's happening in Parliament, and then to take cognizance of those levels, of those scales out there. I would leave it at that, Honourable Chair. And we go to the next one, the functions of the Audit Committee.
Are there any comments with regards to this one? I'm quite comfortable.
Thank you, Chair. The issue of what I want to talk about is the internal audit unit. In clause 50, Parliament must establish an internal audit unit. Now, in terms of when one looks at the Treasury regulations, and we want to get that consistency going. The internal audit unit functions in terms of a charter in the Treasury regulations, and that charter then is drawn up by the audit committee in consultation with the internal audit unit. So my first suggestion would be to clause 48, which speaks about the charter, to there indicate that the drafting of that charter, insofar as it applies to the internal audit unit, must be done in consultation with the internal audit unit. As I understand the Treasury regulations, that's similar to that. And then when we get, why I'm doing this is it's important to understand this, because this will now set the standards how the internal audit unit will be functioning. And we want to get away from the issue of standards prescribed for public entities in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. That is the standard that the bill is currently providing. We want to set Parliament's own standard. So we do it first with the audit charter in clause 48, and then in clause 50 itself, I'm referring there the standard set by the Institute of Internal Auditors. That is a reference that one finds also in the PFMA. But then the PFMA also creates a situation where if there's no standard set, the Treasury can set other standards. So one must actually just also look at exactly what these internal standards of the Institute of Internal Auditors are and what will be applicable for Parliament. So for that purpose, I thought, as with the others, let's put in a clause to say, for the purpose of maintaining consistency with internal audit functions in other organs of state. Now again, I'm doing the organs of state thing. I have something to say about that in the end, but I'm just flagging that again. But in my opinion, this is more or less what we want with the separation of powers issue, Honourable Chair, while maintaining this issue of unified norms and standards. Clause 56 is the next one, Chair. It pertains to the financial statements of Parliament. The issue is the same. Once again, the bill says it must be, the financial statements must be in the format prescribed in terms of the PFMA. The bill also says it must be in accordance with generally recognized accounting practice. One must remember in this instance that the bill defines standards for generally recognized accounting practice in the definition clause. That refers to the Accounting Standards Board. The Accounting Standards Board is also defined in the bill. So my suggestion there, if we want to create a system where Parliament is bound by uniform norms and standards, but is also in charge of its own issues for the separation of power issues, one refers purely to the generally recognized accounting practice, which will then, through the definition clause, will come to the point that the Accounting Standards Board determine those standards, and Parliament will, well, the Minister of Finance, on advice of the Accounting Standards Board, to determine those standards, but then those are applicable. And there again, as I said before, you know, what if there's a gap or there's some issue that has not been determined by the Accounting Standards Board? The Treasury regulations itself allows the Treasury then to determine its own standards. There's also reference to the Public Service Act and the Public Service Regulations there. Now, I'm trying to find a clause there which will then create the issue where you are bound by uniform norms and standards, the Parliament is still in control. And for that purpose, I've added that in accordance with standards, in the absence of an applicable standard, the standards must be in accordance with standards prescribed by the executive authority, but for the purpose of maintaining consistency with other organs of state. So the executive authority, once again, are guided by the Act, or by the bill as it stands at the moment, to come up with applicable standards then by looking at other organs of state. Chair, that is the presentation. On the issue of organs of state, I can add that, you know, why I took organs of state is that it's defined in the Constitution. We know what an organ of state is. When one wants to pick which one of those will be applicable for Parliament, obviously what one has to do is, first of all, go find what is the applicable one. I mean, one can assume it should be a government department rather than a public entity or a constitutional institution. But Parliament is more than a government department, because we have our own treasury. So it won't be a hand-in-glove fit. And we'll have to go do a further bit more research and then maybe define government department in this bill to say government department that's comparable to Parliament. It doesn't solve the problem. It's just, what was it called in Jingling? It just goes around in the circles again.
Thank you, Chair. I think the issue is that it needs to be stated, maybe not necessarily in the bill, but what I would be looking for is to say, well, Parliament has got a certain way that they manage their accounts, and it's stated, so that it can't be flip-flopping. There is a set of standards, and this is what you're going to measure it against, so that in the future you can say, well, this is how it's been done. Yes, it fits. No, it doesn't fit. So I understand the difficulties, but the point that I'm trying to make is that Parliament must say, this is how we're going to do them. We've agreed, and then that is the standard that would go. So I don't know. If that's sufficiently covered here, then my concern is gone away. But that's really what I'm looking for, is the consistency, because you don't want to say there's confusion as to what the standard actually is.
Yeah, I think there are two points at play. The first one is that we say, first the executive must set those standards. We task the executive with the duty of setting them. But again, the other point that Advocate Jenkins raised was the issue of looking at Section 2, which says that if you go back to Section 2, it actually ties down the executive also in the object of the bill as to what it is that should guide the executive. It says we must ensure transparency, accountability, and sound management of revenue expenditure aspects of liability of Parliament. We must ensure a consultative relationship between Parliament and the National Treasury conducted at a high level and based on respect for, one, the constitutional status of Parliament, the constitutional requirement for tabling of money bills, budget processes, standards, and general recognized accounting practice, uniform expenditure classification. So all those things actually bind the executive when they actually make up those standards. So they are actually, you know, bound to uniformity by the objects of the bill. I don't know. Advocate Jenkins.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah, I just want to add to that. That's the important part. That's where you're coming from. But when one looks at the regulation-making process, which is what Dr. George is looking at now, to say that that's not going to be an arbitrary process. The regulations made in terms of Section 65, or Clause 65 as it is at the moment, there's a whole procedure set out how they must be prepared and made, and that they must be publicized, and Parliament must approve them. Okay? And deviation or departures from the regulations may be allowed as long as the objectives of the Act are not undermined. And that's why I'll put in as well the purpose of these issues with the financial statements, the audit committee, and the internal audit unit, which we're going to discuss. Why I've put in for the purpose of maintaining a consistency with other organs of state. Because that must be then a purpose which cannot be undermined. So there would be a specific, in terms of this bill, specific prohibition against going the other way, basically. And the clause of Schedule 4, of course, is the implementation or the transitional arrangements. There, of course, Parliament, until those regulations are made, Parliament is still bound to whatever way it's still bound to the PFMA and its regulations at this point in time. So that's sort of the stick to say, well, get on with your regulations and prepare them. In any case, if this bill comes into operation the first financial year, those regulations must be ready. And I know our Treasury unit in Parliament have been working on regulations, but obviously they can't finalize the drafting until this bill is finalized. So there is a sort of control mechanism which you've alluded to, Dr. Chaudhry. Thanks.
Okay. I think we're fine. Okay. Proceed. Are you done?
Yeah, that's it. I think those are the issues. What I can suggest on the agreement of the committee, to put these wordings that we have in this document into the bill so members can see what it will look like. And those are the issues. The other issues, I don't know if you want me to say anything about that. I think that's another issue of the joint committee being established and so on. I think one must just get clarity still on what is going to happen. I mean, joint committee establishing in draft legislation in terms of the joint rules, there must first be consultation with the joint rules committee on this. But because this bill is a bill that comes from Parliament itself, I think there's still a question, do we really have to go through the joint rules committee through it again? But I think that the committee has, chair has written a letter on that to the speaker. I tried to follow up on that this morning, and it seems that the intention is for that rule to be suspended to facilitate the passing of this bill. But the exact details of when it will be suspended or whether the report must first be a suspension before the committee reports and so on is a different story. I think one must just get clarity on that. But Chair, I think one must just put this in the bill so that one can then go through the bill with a political eye and move on.
Okay. Look, let me recommend that with regards to the issue of the establishment of the committee and the consultation process, let's allow for a period whilst you put these into the bill so that we can go through the bill clause by clause. Can you also get certainty? And if there is any indication from the Speaker's office that we should proceed with the bill, let that be given to us in writing so that the committee can just proceed once we know exactly how that part is going to be handled. So can I request that we allow for time just for that to happen and then bring it back to the committee so that we can go through the bill clause by clause? Because as far as I'm concerned, we actually have finalized the bill. Mr. Mulato.
Mine was, I think, was going to take it further, but maybe I rather not state it, was to establish why are we not able to adopt it now, because I think the mayor work has been done, and if there are any other issues really that the executive authority have to take up, we can take it up with the NCOP, and with the assurance that Mr. Jenkins will stick to what I know he's doing. I'm joking, but that he will stick to what
that's my problem. You must bring the bill here with all these clauses having been written into it. It's a matter of also procedure. We would need to have it in the bill, and for members then we will just go through it clause by clause. And but I agree with you. We actually are in principle. Yes. Yeah. Definitely. No, we're not meeting. We're not meeting later today, so don't rush it for today. But but we can actually do it with our other business next week, because it's not going to take a lot of the committee's time. We will just have to go through it clause by clause, and by then we will also have certainty with regard to the other process regarding the establishment of committee. And with that, thank you. Thanks, Honourable Jenkins. I think it's actually been a lot of hard work. It hasn't been easy for all of us, and I don't want us to go the route of delaying this, because if we do that, we run the risk of starting all over again. So by next week when we meet on Tuesday, I would imagine that we should be able to do this together with the other people. Okay, thank you. I'm told that it is not proper for the chair to adjourn this meeting at this moment, because tea is at 11. And lunch is at 12, so this meeting has to wait until 12 o'clock. I don't know how we're going to handle that, but are we going to come back if members? can't we agree that we come back at 11 for tea and that members won't be here for lunch, and you guys must cancel the lunch? Can we agree that we won't engage in fruitless expenditure for tea, but we are also not going to come back for lunch, so please cancel the lunch. Okay. Thank you.